1. This is an interview between Stan Belcher of the American Alpine Club and Alex Drummond, who lives near Ward in the mountains west of Boulder. He has been a long time climber, super hiker, very famous for long, in some cases several hundred miles long ski tours, often by himself. He's a great man. He's the author of a biography of Enos Mills, and he was the first person to have a disease identified in him called HAPE, H-A-P-E, by Dr. Charles Houston, and that's one reason we're doing this interview. He's a famous man for having a disease, the first of anybody, first of anyone identified.
I'll count to 10, then you say just a couple words, then we'll listen back. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Who are you?
I'm Alex Drummond.
And you're how far away from the mic?
I'm about 4 to 5 feet away.
Oh. And I will put another liquid dollop of coffee. And what's the name of this dog?
Believe it or not, its name's Blueberry.
Blueberry.
Blueberry, because her tongue looks like she's eating blueberries.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, some dogs do have blue tongue. Why do they do that?
Apparently, it betrays a little bit of Chow in her lineage.
Oh, really?
Because Chows characteristically have that.
Yeah. I've always thought of Chows as wicked animals.
Chows are unpredictable and a little bit scary.
Yeah, I think so. My brother has a half Siberian Husky and a half Chow. It's a sweet dog. So somehow we...
Yeah, I think when the chow blood gets diluted, it's good.
They help. Just like some people have wolves, wolf is a terrible domestic pet. But some of them are interbred, I guess they're tolerable. Every half-breed wolf I've known three. Yeah, I wouldn't have them around. Of course, maybe you have one, I don't know.
I had
You did it, yeah, you're one of the people I've known.
And I had one, and it was a Malamute wolf, and it was a sweet animal. But it had no real sense of loyalty.
It just, is that right?
I mean, you could come home from work. You know, you come home from work and dog turns cartwheels out of joy. She just sort of cocked one eye and said, I see you're home.
You're back.
And, yeah. Yeah.
Whoever you are.
Right.
Well, this is not that mysterious, is it? Sure, you know, but we are trying to make a basic tape library for the American Alpine Club, and these tapes will be the property of the American Alpine Club Library, based in Golden. My wife thinks that there are copyright issues which the club needs to get a lawyer to look at, so that we don't have some writer come in and take the tapes home and say, I'm going to copyright them, they're mine. She's afraid that might happen. I never heard of that happening. But there are unethical journalists in the world.
Yeah. Right.
So it may be that sooner or later we'll have a form for you to sign or something, one for Charlie. But at this point, why we're assuming that because the tape says it's going to be the property of the American Alpine Club, and you understand it, I understand it, I think that's enough myself. But that's as nice as it is. Anyway, that's what we intend to do with it. And the focus in this case, eventually, if not right away, will be this cardinal event in the life of Dr. Charles Houston, because apparently it was your coming to him as a patient that helped get him into this area of research. He'd done a lot of research prior to then for the Navy in World War II on the human being using oxygen at in fighter planes and at high altitude. And in fact, he developed ways for Navy fighter pilots to climb higher than they should without oxygen and take huge gulps. They could last for several minutes above the level Japanese planes could last. It was he gave us momentary advantage. Later came, of course, pressurized cabins. That didn't matter. So he did important research even in World War II. But then came back to Burlington, Vermont, and eventually to Aspen to be, as he says, a country doctor doing just a practice. And events kept interfering with his life. Okay. But in this case, we're talking here in his home, which is a mountain cabin near Ward, Colorado. And we're practically at 9,000 feet. We just checked it out on three different versions of altimeters. And you've been living here for how long?
I moved here in 82.
So I've been living
here almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years.
In this old cabin.
It's hard for some of us to realize that. By the way, for the purpose of whoever's listening to the tape, I've known Alex Stroman for many, many years, long before he moved up here, which makes me very old indeed. And let's establish those basic facts. What's your name?
My name is Alex Drummond.
You were at one time known to most of us as Ron Cox.
That's right. For purely personal reasons, I did a legal change of name, taking my grandfather's name in 1989. And that was both my psyche and my friends applauded my unloading a name that had never fit me.
Okay.
So that's, yeah. And at the 10-year mark, I stopped giving explanations.
You don't need to.
And most people now, all of my new friends, never knew me by an old name.
I'm sure I can mention that name.
And are astonished at
that. Many mountain club gatherings, and nobody would know who that was.
Yeah.
And I'd say, well, some old timer, someone used to know. Did you publish anything under that name?
Under which?
Ron Cox.
I published lots of articles working for NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research.
Okay.
And I also published about 1980, I published an article in Outside Magazine about the first ski across the state of Colorado, three-man expedition that skied from just outside of Durango to the Medicine Bow west of Fort Collins.
Okay.
That was under Ron Cox.
Okay. I mention that because though you and I are both still young fellows, we're going to get older, hopefully, and people may want to do research on you. Right now, we're concerned with Charlie Houston, but let's face it, you're kind of a character, too. So people should know if they want to do a total bibliography on you that there are some of these early things, including a mountain type article in Outside Magazine. What was the year of that?
I can check the exact date if you'd like me to go get the copy.
But you know it was Outside Magazine.
It was Outside, yeah. It was just when Outside Magazine was changing from it was Mariah, then it was Outside Mariah, and then it was Outside. I think it was already Outside by the time my article was published. The trip that the article described was in 1978, but I think the article was either 79 or 80, and it's called High and Light.
High and Light.
Across Colorado, something like that.
Okay. Very good. Now, since the name change, I know that you've done a major biography of Enos Mills.
Right.
Which was roughly, what year did that come out?
It came out in 95.
1995. And you spent years of work on that.
Spent years of work on that, yeah, I did. And that was published by University Press of Colorado.
Okay.
And it was a full Life and Times biography.
Right. And for those of you who don't know about Enos Mills, many of us in Colorado think of him as kind of a John Muir of the Rockies. He was another, largely self-taught naturalist. Isn't that a term they often use?
He was a naturalist. Indeed, he was self-taught. Indeed, he aspired to be the John Muir of the Rockies.
He did consciously?
Consciously.
Well, that
yeah.
That.
He was a disciple, a worshiper, and an emulator of John Muir, and a national park apostle, the nominative, the nominal father of Rocky Mountain National Park.
That's what we hear, that he played a really major role, and that's true, I guess.
It's true.
In creating Rocky Mountain National Park.
That's right, that's true. Okay. There are some who don't want to accord him all of that glory.
Yeah.
He was very eager for that glory. But in most circles, he's considered at least the prime mover and shaker, but many others contributed. He also wrote about 18 books and was a famous innkeeper of Longspeak Inn. Famous, the really first famous guide on Long's Peak.
He probably set the record, didn't he, for a sense of Long's Peak?
Yeah, he did. He, at the time, the record's been broken since, but he climbed, I think, 304 times, something like that.
I mean, that's amazing.
That's a lot of times. Yeah, and
I've done it 19 times. I think that's a lot. That's nothing.
19's a lot.
Nothing to him.
He did it probably several dozen times in the moonlight, which is a big fashion in those days.
Yeah, right. Wonderful. All right, let's go back just a little bit earlier. We won't get all the facts of your total life, though it may sound like I'm aspiring to that. But I would like us to go back to where I start all these interviews. And that is, if you could just, you are relaxed. You're having herbal tea, and it's in this warm room, heated by a wood stove. The dog's asleep at your feet. Very relaxing scene. Almost like a Norman Rockwell scene of rural America. But relax even more, and I'd like you to think back to hopefully visual, your earliest visual memory. No matter how short or how long.
Oh, any visual memory at all? Oh, okay.
Yeah, but early, and well, let's say earliest, but you know, who knows what's earliest.
The radio above the kitchen door in the house in Boulder that said that Franklin Roosevelt had just died, and seeing my parents break into tears. It's one of my earliest visual memories. And so that was 1945. Now
I was eight.
I was already seven. But that's nevertheless one of my earliest visual memories. I also have a visual memory of staggering into my parents' bedroom early one morning after my brother had taken a flying leap from the springs of the bed, landing on me. So I was stretched out on the floor. We were practicing jumping over each other using the bed as a trampoline. He fell short and landed in the middle of my back. I got up, staggered into my parents' bedroom, and I could still see myself walking in there. And then I fainted. I also, at about that time, have a visual memory of being in Boulder Canyon on a foggy Sunday morning, walking with my mother up toward Boulder Falls and seeing a huge rock come rolling down the hill. There was a mine up there at that time.
Seeing the rock come down.
What's that?
You actually were seeing the rock come down.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was a miner up there who had thrown the rock thinking nobody was around. And my mother, I saw she picked me up, swung me out of the way, but by being picked up, I was taller, and the rock hit me in the leg instead of in the head.
That's another
visual memory.
Uh-huh.
And the miner came down, panicked, and took us to the company doctor, and
All right. They
got fixed up. So those are my earliest visual recollections. Probably the strongest of those, though, is that radio above the kitchen door when FDR died. That's very imprinted on my memory.
Yeah.
The shape and the size of the radio, the color of the wall and the shelf, and then my parents starting to sob.
The impact of grief.
Yeah.
This person. What's your earliest memory? You've given one of your mother, but let's try your father. What's your earliest memory of your father?
earliest memory of my father, one of my probably lots of visual images of just him around the house, him coming home from work, carrying his briefcase and his top coat and hat. But I also have both an emotional and visual memory of standing in the backyard when I was young. We had started hiking together very early.
Uh-huh.
And he put his arm on my shoulder and pointed up to Saddle Rock. There's a
Saddle Rock.
Rock formation on the side of Green Mountain above Boulder.
Right.
And saying, what would you think about trying to make our way without a trail up? And then he pointed out a slope below Saddle Rock that we could maybe get directly to Saddle Rock without following the Green Mountain Trail.
Uh-huh.
I can still remember that delicious father-son moment.
Okay.
And I don't know how old I was, but then we did start hiking pretty early, and then when I was 10, we climbed Lawns Peak together.
Okay.
With the summer CU Rec Department.
So here's an early mountain foundation with your father.
Yeah.
Directly.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, you did give the early one of your mother, but let's try again. What's your earliest, and early, but fairly early possible, visual memory of your mother?
I can still remember her distraught face with a can of paint remover trying to remove. My brother painted me red.
Painted you where?
Well, in the yard, and it was oil-based paint. And I can remember her horror at the situation, and I can see her face as she began to scrub me down with whatever paint remover she used. That's actually a very toxic thing to do to the body.
It's not a good thing to do. That's
yeah.
Right. 07, one of his girlfriends gets killed by being covered with paint, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Well, so that has nothing to do with our interview here. We haven't established whether you were older or younger than this brother.
I was 15 months younger.
And did you have other brothers or sisters?
That was the only one.
Okay.
The only sibling.
Well, let's try earliest memory of him.
Jumping on my back.
Okay.
Painting me. We had a lot of these kinds of interactions. Good-natured fighting and sometimes ill-natured fighting, but lots of strong dynamic between us.
Did he go on really early hikes too?
No. Unfortunately, want to, and when my father would suggest that the three of us go for a hike, he would say he didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So that left my father for me alone, and so we developed a bond around the mountains that my brother, maybe he regrets now, but at the time, just let go.
He's still very much alive, I take it.
He's alive, but not very much alive.
Oh, I'm sorry, well, I didn't mean
it. Okay. He's in bad health.
We're at the age, Ron. I mean, Alex.
Yeah.
We shouldn't expect that everybody's going to be healthy, because many of us are not that healthy. Okay. Well, anyway. So I gather that you didn't do a lot of hiking with the brother.
None. Virtually none.
Virtually none.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lots with my father. And then as I...
Age 10 up longs. That's pretty good.
Age 10 up longs. And then I started rock climbing about... ninth grade, something like that, and my parents made me take the CMC climbing school.
Oh yeah.
So I did that.
Which would have been roughly what year?
Well, it's roughly 51 or 2.
51 or 2.
51 or 2.
That would have been before, I imagine. Yeah. Okay. Now, you entered, I'm going to make a wild guess, Boulder Public Schools.
Went through all of the Boulder Public Schools.
Okay.
That's right. K through 12.
Think of yourself as a second grader, if you can. In other words, early in your school career. And you look down on yourself, now you're an older person looking down at this little second grader. What kind of kid do you see there?
Uh, I was quick with my schoolwork. I got along well with other kids, but I was also kind of a loner, and I maintained that paradox all through school. I was popular, well-liked, and had lots of friends, but I was also a loner.
Okay. You were not uncomfortable spending chunks of time alone.
Not a bit.
Which drives some kids batty.
That's right.
Okay.
And I was a very much of a wind mystic. I would go into fits fits of ecstasy when the wind would shriek and howl.
Really?
And I had a little cottage that we had during the war years, which was low rent cottage. My father was a professor of French who earned very little, as professors earned then.
Right.
And we had, for the war years, we moved to a small cottage back by the alley on 14th Street in Boulder. And
this is University of Colorado, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I had the top bunk in this tiny room with bunk beds, but I could open the window in a way that it would. I could get all the sound effects of the wind without being drafted on.
Yeah.
It was one of the most delicious things I can remember, is those sounds of the wind. And it also howled through the telephone wires that went that ran down the alley.
Yeah, I know. Funny.
Yeah. And then I used to go up Chautauqua and even into the foothills and just stand in the wind. And I don't know where I got that. And I still love wind, although sometimes I get mad at the wind now when it's blowing hard against me and I'm, trying to make headway against it.
It just inevitably leaps into one's mind that one of your latter heroes you wrote about, Ennis Mills, like to climb trees, did he not?
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And be in the tree swaying in the wind.
That's exactly. He called it den. He called the tree his dance partner.
His dance partner. Okay, well.
And he got that habit from Muir, who did the same thing.
Oh, did he? Oh,
and Muir could actually tell the kind of tree by how it vibrated and swayed in the wind.
Well, I suppose one could, with enough experience.
Yeah.
But you as a little guy didn't literally climb the tops of trees.
No, I didn't
just
climb the tops of trees, but I was absolutely...
You enjoyed wind at any altitude.
Worthy and fits of ecstasy.
Really?
Standing in the wind and listening to the wind at night from where I lay in my bed.
Okay. So if we were to look at you when you entered, which in those days I think was called junior high school, or was it middle school?
She was junior high then.
Junior high. Let's do the same thing. Here's a teacher teaching the first year of this seventh grade. She looks around the kids and she looks down at you. I'm assuming it's a she, because most teachers were women in those days. What would she see at this point?
She'd see a sweet kid and a bright kid and a bit of a monster. I like a lot of junior high kids, I had about 2.5 years of monsterdom.
Okay.
Junior high, where I got into lots of mischief and I got an F for every class had three grades, one of which was personal social relationships.
Oh, yeah,
I got
right.
an F. I got an F in personal social relationships because I had torment of the teacher so much, and I couldn't show that to my parents, so I changed the F to a B at a friend's house. We very carefully changed the F to a B. Of course, that got that naturally, that was found out.
Yes.
But by that time, I was very ardent about hiking. I was confused about girls at the time. And didn't want to learn how to dance. I turned a girl down and asked me to the Sadie Hawkins dance in eighth grade. And I saw that girl this last summer, summer of 2000 at our 45th class high school.
Was she
reunion.
Still a little miffed at you? Or?
Well, I apologize. I apologize after all this. She was very touched. There was another woman standing nearby who said how touched she was that I would do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but this girl, who I secretly had a crush on, of all the women at that reunion, she was the most interesting. So
your early taste was vindicated.
My early taste was vindicated.
My goodness. I'm beginning to think reunions are much more important than I used to think they were. I've enjoyed both of mine, both high school and college, and my wife has enjoyed hers, and I keep hearing people who have great times.
I think they're a unique opportunity to see a group of people, all of whom are identical age.
Your cohort, that's right.
And all of whom have at least one thing in common, that they graduated the same year from the same school.
Right.
And
they knew a lot of people that you knew.
So yeah. Yeah. And there were some really interesting people. They're retired professors and, mm-hmm. Artists and so on. So it was quite interesting.
I don't want to go to that. I'll go if they'll just invite me. Yeah. So, let's get your age at that CMC school you went through.
Well, it's probably, I graduated at 17, so take off 3 or 4 from that, so roughly 13 or 14, I started climbing. My mother had been a rock climber.
Oh, okay. That's not...
She was the fifth woman to climb the east face of Long's Peak.
Really?
She dated the Long brothers.
Yeah.
She was a Boulder girl. She dated Carlton and Everett Long.
Yeah, all right.
And so...
Grew
irises.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Everett did. And then she knew lots of other climbers, Paul Cook, and this was one name that I can remember. Anyway, she was the fifth woman to climb these massive long peaks, so she no longer climbed, didn't even like to hike much anymore. But I think I got part of my ambition to be a climber from her. And I was, by that time, avidly reading mountaineering books.
All right, what's the first mountaineering book?
The one I can remember most clearly is Kingdom of Adventure. Oh, James Ramsey Ullman's account of the Everest expeditions.
Right.
And I actually copied some of the maps out of there and traced some of the photographs and learned all of the names of everything.
Did you get that out of the library, or was that a personal book?
It's a personal book that I still have. Yeah.
So somebody gave it to you, or did you buy it?
I think my father got it through the Book of the Month Club, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the other early titles of any really company?
Climbs and Explorations in the Canadian Rockies by somebody, Collier, a fellow of the Royal Society, which I stupidly gave away later.
It's available in Golden. Okay.
Is it?
Still,
you know
there.
That book, huh?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Book.
Yeah. I remember that very clearly. There were also, by the time I went into high school, some of my climbing buddies and I began to find climbing books in the high school library. There were a few.
Really?
There was even a novel about a Swiss guy who had a wooden leg but could still climb mountains.
Well, I don't know. Really?
Yeah.
And sounds there was like Jeffrey Winthrop Young, the Englishman, only they made him a Swiss.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's a wonderful book about a Norwegian partisan who escaped the Nazis on skis.
Yeah.
And skied something like 70 miles a day for a week or something.
Somehow I vaguely know them.
Yeah.
And some of the old ones we always think of, how about Whimper Scrambles in the Alps?
Was that? I read that. I read a lot of stuff.
Right.
And memorized the altitudes of mountains.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. And you knew the difference between a meter and a yard probably fairly early.
Fairly early, yeah, because I had our high school science teachers taught us the metric system.
Right, yeah. Now, okay, you were a reader. It's obvious just from what you said. Did you read other kinds of things than just outdoor adventure?
My taste for, quote, literature was late in development. I was more interested at that time in reading mountaineering stuff and adventure stuff.
Right.
On family trips in the car, my father would read out loud while my mother was driving, and we read Jack London kind of stuff, Far North Adventures, James Oliver, Curwood.
Oh, okay.
Forget who else, but that was what my taste was. And my taste for belles lettres came much later.
Right. Well, you mentioned that your brother really was quite a climber, especially for a woman in those days, if I may carefully phrase it.
Yeah.
And she'd pretty much given that up by the time you had come along.
Yeah. When she got married, she wanted to have babies.
Yeah, well,
be a mother.
And the culture said to do,
she,
isn't it?
She really lost all interest in, even in hiking, pretty much.
But your dad did some hiking all along.
He did some hiking all along. That's right.
Did he ever take a climbing school? Was that?
No, he
that
never,
wasn't his
he never. He did, I think he didn't. Just didn't come along at the right time to become a climber.
Yeah.
Even his boots were those boots that lace halfway up your calves.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
My dad had the same.
And he wore a necktie sometimes when we'd go hiking.
A necktie.
In the old pictures.
How about a scarf?
No scarf,
okay,
but he did wear it. And one of his old friends was named Kurt Skinner, who had become the superintendent of Yellowstone, and then was later the superintendent of Mount Rainier,
uh-huh,
which enabled me, through a connection whose value I didn't sufficiently appreciate at the time, to get a job as a fire lookout for 2 summers at Mount Rainier when I was an undergraduate.
Okay.
Those were idyllic summers. I'm jumping too far ahead, maybe.
That's all right. We don't want to lose that, though. We got you into high school. You've taken this course. You're climbing. Are you climbing mostly with peers, guys?
Climbing with peers, high school buddies. There were some very good climbers a couple of years ahead of me in high school. Skip Green was one of them.
Skip
Corbin
Green.
Simmons, I don't know if you know that.
I know both of those.
Carl Gustafson. They were, and Lynn, somebody, they were way better climbers than we were, but they were kind of our role models. John Clark was another one.
John Clark?
Yeah.
Is he older than you?
Yeah, they were all, two or three years older.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Or they were seniors when I was a sophomore or something like that.
And you guys typically you weren't going on CMC trips, you were doing what you wanted to do.
And we were right tail end of the old style climbing before the new standards began to kick in. So I never climbed Red Guard Wall. The hardest things I ever climbed were Friday's Folly, Northwest Passage.
Northwest Passage is not easy? Okay. By my standards.
East Ridge of the Maiden.
Yeah.
But nothing in El Dorado Canyon. Not the hardest climbs on Castle Rock. I never got around to climbing Stettner's Ledges on Bonds Peak. We climbed the window. Almost, we got turned back by ice just before the window.
It was hard. So,
you know, we were competent, but not by today's standards, acrobatic climbers at all. We were just kids out rock climbing.
I'm not sure what the right words are here. I'm a poet, you're my poet, but we're kind of groping here. Would you call yourself in those days a passionate climber, a fanatic? You just enjoy being in the outdoors? What was the degree of your...
It was pretty passionate. I was
pretty passionate.
I was pretty gung-ho, but not to the extent that I would train or lift weights or do any special preparation. We just would go climbing. We were safety-minded,
okay,
and but you know, still got scared sometimes. I felt limitations. We were careful. We weren't very systematic in what we set, what our goals were. For example, I've always regretted that I never did any rock climbing in the Wind Rivers in Wyoming, and just backpacked there for the first time last summer.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Found them so wonderful, sure. Wonderful granite mountains that which now I had climbed on.
I've done a little there. I wish I had done more. You mentioned that you had some near escapes. Describe maybe the nearest near catastrophe in these early days of climbing.
If we put me up into my undergraduate years now,
you're a young adult.
Yeah, say. Young adult.
Or an old teenager.
Two close calls. One was in the Tetons on Jensen ridge of Symmetry Spire, which is a hard climb.
Oh, yeah.
Rocks came down very close. Yeah, a bunch of rocks, probably.
Oh, really?
8 or 10 grapefruit-sized rocks came down, just missing us. We were hugging this vertical wall, and the rocks just grazing off of us.
Just nature, and somebody dislodged them.
Or
could you tell?
You never know. Yeah, sure. And the second one was on the cliffs above the Puyallup River in Mount Rainier, where I took a leader fall, and the rope cut. The rope was cut by a rock that I pulled loose as I started to fall. Mm-hmm. He lay held me. I swung in under a piton, stepped onto a ledge, and then looked down. And a split second after the rope had checked my fall, this falling rock had cut the rope. And we only had one rope with us. We had this guy Fred that I was with had 120 feet of parachute cord, so we did the one rope rappel kind of a thing. The 120 foot climbing rope cut at about the 80 foot mark.
Okay.
So we could do 80 foot rappels. It took us three or four rappels to get off the cliff.
And use the parachute cord to retrieve your rope.
The parachute cord to pull down.
I've heard of that technique, yeah. But I don't know I've ever heard anyone actually using it.
Yeah.
I used to always see that in early guidebooks as a way.
Yeah, it works in a pinch.
I'll be damned. Okay, well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And just the two of you, so you figure that out at the time.
I think, Stanley, I had maybe practiced that with Kerry Houston in the climbing school.
Okay. Oh, really? Well,
yeah.
Maybe somebody I taught in those days. I doubt that they did that, but it's worth knowing. It requires a separate little ring, doesn't it?
Descending ring.
Descending ring, okay.
Yeah. Which most people carried one or two in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. I still carry one, but I don't ever use it.
Yeah.
Some of us are very old fashioned. All right. Were any of your buddies in those early days killed?
Yes. Well, a buddy of a buddy was killed. High school chum named Harry Earle, right after graduation, he went to the Army. He was stationed at White Sands, and he and two other guys that he was in the Army with had an accident on Shiprock, and he wasn't killed, but one of the guys was.
Okay.
Then also, some people I knew, an undergraduate, a guy named Prince Wilmot.
I know Prince. Yes.
That sounds like a German duke or something. But
Prince was his first name.
Prince was his first name.
Yeah.
He was from Arkansas, and he and another guy whose name I can't remember, and a girl named Jane Ben Dixon, tried to climb the east face of logs in spring of 1960, April 1960. And we didn't make it. Tried to go down the west side to Sand Beach Lake, and Prince was so cold he fell out of the rappel and was killed. The other guy was froze to death. Jane miraculously made it down the mountain.
I know now. I know we can.
I've
occasionally used that in lectures on mountain safety. That no matter how bad things are, you just keep going, you'll come out sometime.
That's she right. just kept somehow. Going, came out on the highway by me.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle what she,
yeah.
what she did.
Yeah.
Right. That's where Prince Little bought the bar. Okay. Harry Earle, this has nothing to do with our interview particularly, but Harry Earle died later, did he not? And I've never understood the circumstances.
I don't either, except
somebody
that
told Jenny a bizarre story.
I heard that Harry Earle had committed suicide. And one fine day at work at National Center for Atmospheric Research, a guy named Chuck Catlin, something like that, said, I was over in Redstone, and I met an old friend of yours named Harry Earle, and he says to say hi.
Oh my God.
And I said, what? Harry Earle committed suicide. And he said, it turns out that Harry Earle's father, Harry Earle Sr., had committed suicide.
Okay.
And he
had been a kind of an itinerant carpenter who had helped build scaffolding for Gross Dam, Gross Reservoir, Boulder. He had been morose for a number of things, including unemployment, and had taken a gun up and gone up to north to a lonely hillside in North Park, that lonely North Park in northern Colorado, and shot himself. And I had thought that was my friend Harry earlier.
Yeah.
Anyway, Chuck Catlin said that Harry was not very well adjusted, was having problems with his employer, and whatever job he had over him, Redstone. Did I say Redstone or Redcliff? Redstone.
He went
over above Carbondale.
Yeah, right.
And then a couple of months later, Chuck said that Harry had been either quit or had been fired and moved to Oregon. And then I later heard that he was writing cowboy novels. That's all. That's the last I heard of the guy.
No.
I've never checked books in print to see if there are any cowboy novels by a guy named Harry.
He published, I think, a story in the Saturday Evening Post when he was still a Boulderite.
Okay.
Jenny reported that, and I thought, my God, I'd already met him because I was back in the Korean War. Harry Earl, and I know Harry Earl, I can think of him as a literary type, you know. I was kind of impressed. And he just dropped out of our life, and well, the bizarre story she'd heard was that somebody had found his bones and he had been possibly killed in a gangland kind of thing or what. And but nobody ever confirmed that. And what you have to say makes much more sense. So probably somebody saw in a little article about somebody named Harry Earl shooting himself. Yeah. Thing. All right, well, the interview for me is already worthwhile. You filled in a little piece of
Fistin.
We don't know where he went from there on. You filled in a little piece. Because he was an interesting kid with a lot of, he had his passion himself. But I never would have thought of him as a literary type. All right, you get out of high school. Didn't have a taste yet much for literature as such.
Right. In fact, a science major. I was a forestry major my freshman year, a botany major my sophomore year, chemistry major my junior and senior years.
Okay.
And I didn't really want to be any of those things.
All right.
But by that time, 4 years were up, so I took my chemistry degree, knowing full well I didn't want to be a chemist. Don't ever tell Dr. Walton.
It would have been your, okay.
I hated analytical chemistry so much in my junior year that when I turned my Bunsen burner in, I filled it full of glue so it could never be used
this
again.
This is a tragic thing to say. We assume the statute of limitations is run out.
Right.
Oh, shoot.
But as an undergraduate, I took a couple of poetry appreciation courses and an art history course and things that satisfied broader tastes than just science. And was beginning to realize.
Your father taught French?
My father taught French, yeah. He was very much of a literati.
Okay, and he read in the car as you were doing cross country trips?
Yeah.
Out loud. Your mother, did she have?
She'd been an English major.
Okay.
She read stuff from the Book of the Month Club, but didn't really exert much of an influence. In fact, she rebelled against what for her was the arid world of scholarship.
Yeah.
Didn't like it when my father assembled his French-speaking colleagues in the living room and they talked about French novels.
Uh-huh. She didn't want to sit in on those and listen avidly. At some point, they split up.
They split up. Yeah,
you were roughly how old?
I was right about the time I was a sophomore in college, in high school.
When high school? Oh.
In high school, yeah. I was 14. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And I lived with my mother, but saw my father often. And when I was a sophomore in college, he was killed in a plane crash in Paris.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. That would have been hard on you.
That was hard.
You had a good bond of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, boy. I should have asked you earlier, what was your first experience with death? It's usually grandparents. Well, I'll do it. What was your first experience with death?
First experience was when his mother died. It was my grandmother, who I didn't know very well. But I vividly had an open coffin funeral. I remember vividly seeing this waxen old woman lying there. And then I remember the burial out on the windswept winter South Dakota prairie.
South Dakota.
And I mean, with, you know, tatters of paper blowing off the barbed wire.
I can believe it.
And howling prairie wind.
I can believe it.
A small group of people out there on the prairie. It was quite a vivid experience.
And how old were you?
I was young, probably eight or something.
Eight or nine.
Okay. Yeah. And we drove up there for that. From older. So.
And so what was the next experience of death?
Guess my father.
Your father?
My father, yeah.
Well, that was abroad. Did you go abroad, or did they bring the body here? How do people handle crises like that?
There was the plane had burned on impact. It crashed on takeoff. Took the top of an apartment house off.
Oh boy!
And burst into flames from the transatlantic fuel load. So people were pretty badly treated. It's an identification for a long, long time.
Right.
And then his remains were sent. They were sent to Boulder, and he was buried in Green Mountain Cemetery.
Did you play any role in the ceremony, or?
There wasn't really much of a ceremony, but there was a kind of a grotesque situation. He had remarried, and then pried him away from the new wife.
Actually,
they went to Paris together, and then he died. Partly trying to escape her.
Yeah.
Anyway, she showed up as the widow. The two women claimed to be the widow.
Okay.
And one accompanied the remains back to the States. And then she later went crazy and was committed. So, there it was. Very weird.
Yes. Life can be very, very strange. Okay. And did that have much effect on your mother? I mean, she...
No, she was concerned for my sake and for my brother's sake.
Right.
But she was, by that time, enough detached to didn't really cause her any major grieving.
All right, and the one peer death you mentioned, we've gotten you through college as a semi-willing science major, many sciences, ending with chemistry together. How did you see yourself? What are we, age 21 now?
Age 21. I saw myself, I was very uncertain about what I wanted to do. Convinced that maybe I'd be a climber for the rest of my life. There was kind of a cult, a blood brotherhood that we would never stop climbing.
Do
you remember that kind of thing?
Yeah, but talk about it a little. That's important.
Yeah. Because a lot of people did climb for a while and then would quit.
Right.
And they'd get married and stuff like that. And I noticed to some extent that as I started to get interested in girls, I had a little bit less ardor for climbing and wondered if maybe there was a Freudian connection after all.
Well,
I don't know if you remember Harold Walton's article about his essay. That people liked so much, called Mountaineering, Science, Mountaineering, and something or another. It was an article.
I remember the article, but I remember him talking about the peculiar.
You should look that up.
More science than you might. The ranks of climbers are filled out with more scientists than logically should have been.
How scientists sometimes high up on the mountain get their best ideas when they're not trying to. One of the benefits of climbing is that it completely engages you in the present moment, so you can't dwell on other things. On the other hand, sometimes good ideas pop into your mind, and he cites a whole bunch of climber scientists from going back to
people like
Damn, I gotta look this up.
Yeah, it's
was it in the Alvin Journal or do you know where it was?
I think it was in the Colorado Quarterly.
Colorado.
And later reprinted someplace else, but it first appeared in the, what was then called the Colorado Quarterly. I think it's significant from the standpoint of DeVries local mountaineering history in that everybody read and loved this essay. It was very spry and articulate in what Walton's in
the way.
As right. he was, yeah. And kind of impish, but also, you know, serious. Anyway, but in that, he debunks quite roundly the idea that of some people that climbing has something to do with a sublimation of the sexual urge.
Yeah.
And
I can imagine you would have to.
But anyway, I and others that I knew did in fact slack off on climbing as we began to get interested
well,
in women.
You found there are two things worthwhile in the world.
That's right.
Just one. Whether the two are interchangeable is another question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you were hardly dating at all, if at all, in high school.
I had a passionate romance with a girl named Maggie, who went to South High in Denver. We climbed the East Face together.
Oh, really?
We climbed the East Face together when I was a senior. But she was a year ahead of me in school.
Oh, okay.
So she was a freshman at CU and I was a senior in high school. So she dropped me.
Oh, it made a huge difference in those days.
That's right. She dropped me.
Yeah,
but
right.
I just now, about 2 weeks ago, got a picture of myself and her in the old Timberline cabin on Long's Peak.
Yeah, I remember.
Sue O'Brien. Mike O'Brien's wife had taken this picture, and she was going through some old files, and she found it and printed it up for me. And that was from a trip that she and Maggie and I had tried to do the Chasm Lake in May 1954. We'd gotten hit by an incredibly intense snow squall. We were on skis. It knocked us over. We staggered over to that ruin of a timberline cabin.
Right.
Built by Enos Mills, by the way.
Was it?
Yeah. And his brother Joe. Didn't have a roof. Well, we took her out. We basically bivouacked for the night there.
Oh, I've bivouacked in that way. It's nothing but a wind shelter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
College. I mean, we're in college now.
Yeah.
Climbing was it your thing in women still, or were you too high?
Just sort of beginning to date. But climbing was the bigger passion. I had a wonderful living situation, or eating situation. I ate in a boarding house.
Oh, yeah.
Boarding houses don't exist any longer, but it was kind of a climber's boarding house. There was a bunch of us who were climbers.
We took
our meals at a place called Robinson's. And my good friend, Stu Krebs, was one of the people there. And he introduced me to cross-country skiing.
Oh, really?
And that's an interesting story to me because there was at that time collegiate cross-country Nordic racing.
Right.
But there was no recreational.
Like
there was no recreational cross-country skiing.
Right.
And Stu, inspired by his roommate who was a racer, took a pair of old army surplus skis, and cut them down with a saw.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I went to the army store, got a pair of army surplus downhill skis, and made them narrower with a saw.
Oh, you did?
Made it narrower with a saw. And then, one day I was up at Brainerd Lake, actually some of us had camped out above Brainerd Lake in the snow, but then we met two Norwegians, and one of them was named Johan Magnusson, and he was I was still in high school, no, I couldn't have been in high school because I was two, so I was going to say I was a freshman. Johan was so impressed that these young kids had cut down skis, and when he went back to Norway a year later, he sent me a pair of official Norwegian cross-country skis.
Can we pinpoint the year? This
would actually have been 1956 or 7.
Wow.
He would have sent me those, and those were the skis that I had, and the boots that he sent me that I had on my snowmass.
Famous trip. But by then you had been cross-country skiing for 2-3 years.
Yeah, Right.
Yeah, okay.
And so I had done some ski touring on downhill skis with Skims.
Well, I did that was fun, but a hell of a lot of work.
I found cross-country skis, well-waxed, way better. And
I'm
absolutely amused to see that things have gone full circle now. You see people out on purely Nordic terrain now with heavy skis and Skims.
And Skims, I know. It's sad. And others are using snowshoes.
Yeah.
I gave up snowshoes happily 30 years ago. They're still in my attic. Oh, well. Oh, well. So, all right, so you're out of college. You're not sure what you're going to do. Higher intimations of Mount Rainier. Is that right away? Or?
The Rainier summers were during college.
Oh, during college.
Yeah, and of course, the famous pulmonary edema episode was during college, too. So
I guess it would have been.
Yeah, so.
And you were at Mount Rainier, was that?
Yeah, I was at Mount Rainier for two summers, 57 and 58, and had my first.
So, did you happen to know Dave Lynn? Wasn't he a ranger about that time?
I didn't know him. I knew him a little bit in college because I did a couple of ski trips with him, but I didn't know him as a ranger at Mount Rainier.
Okay, well, maybe it was before that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So, in college, you're still doing a lot of climbing, beginning maybe to explore the world of women, but already learning cross-country skiing.
Right.
And in fact, getting a pair of real cross-country skis.
Right.
Through Mayo, et cetera, et cetera. What were some of your early tours then on skis?
We were pretty ambitious. For example, I did a solo trip from Boulder to Winter Park in probably. I was a sophomore. There had been heavy,
one day or did you camp?
Heavy, heavy spring snows.
Okay.
So then it crusted. So I started skiing right up Gregory Canyon, Gregory Gulch, past Costler's Ranch.
Yes.
Went by compass to 70 degrees west, up over through what's now the Forsyth Valley. All it had then was an old broken down homestead. It's now a subdivision.
Right.
Dropped somewhere off Magnolia, down. Came out somewhere near Rollinsville, went up the East Portal Valley to East Portal, and then over Corona Pass and down through Winter Park. It took me 3 days.
3 days? Okay.
3 days, right.
And you were using a tent or just a sleeping bag?
I think I just slept out. The second, just above East Portal, I slept in an old cabin. And I wrote an article about that when I was which was in a magazine called Colorado Magazine, which was run by a guy named Newell Fogelberg, who may be the father of the singer Dan Fogelberg. Maybe. Is Dan Fogelberg a Boulder boy?
I don't know. I don't.
Okay.
I've heard the name, but
anyway,
I don't pay much attention to that kind of music.
So I wrote an article called Solo on Skis.
Solo on Skis?
Yeah.
Was that your first published work, can I ask?
Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah. I named the Petit Grépin. We climbed, we made probably the second ascent of the Petit Grépin, and I wrote an article for Trail and Timberline, which I dubbed it the Petit Grépin. Didn't have a name until then.
That's pretty much stuck, I think.
Yeah, it stuck. Yeah, it stuck. And the reason I called it that is from my wide reading in mountaineering literature, I decided it looked like the real Grépin in the French Alps.
We all heard about the Grépin
and
the mummery crack of the Grépin.
Exactly.
And the famous phrase, it's impossible when it's difficult, then it's an easy day for a lady.
Right.
I think mummery said when he heard that a woman had done his crack. So, you know. All right. Somewhere in there, you may have run into a friend of mine named Bill Buckingham.
Yes, I knew Buckingham. We went to the Gore Range in the wintertime.
Oh, really?
In fact, it was right after, the solo trip to Winter Park.
Oh.
I met Michael Sue O'Brien and Bill Buckingham and Harry Earl.
Harry Earl, okay.
We had a letter of permission to go up the valley from Black Lake into the Gore Range. The letter of permission was from a guy named Vanderburg in Denver.
Vanderburg.
Who not owned the Olinger Mortuaries
His daughter
produced a daughter named Marilyn.
Named Marilyn, who was Miss America.
Yeah, okay.
And we went down to Denver. He was an ogre. We disliked him. And many years later, that instinctive dislike was vindicated because Marilyn later went public with the fact that she had been a incestuously abused girl all through her growing up.
Yeah.
And her late father, old man Vanderburg, had been the villain in this.
Right.
And we didn't like the guy just instinctively.
Well, we don't.
We went to the Olinger mortuaries in Denver to get the letter from him, and he handed us the letter, which we handed to the caretaker,
right,
the property we had to go through. And anyway, that was with Buckingham. And
what year would that have been? 52 or 53? 52, yes.
If
you're still in college.
Mike, I didn't know Mike O'Brien until I was in college. Well, maybe not. Could have been in high school, because I could have known Mike, because he was in college, but we probably knew each other in climbing circles, so that could have been in high school. There's also a woman named Martha Steinmetz, who was a mama on that trip. She became one of the doyens of Aspen later.
That's where I heard it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, we tried to climb Mount Powell, and it was too...
On skis?
Well,
from the base up.
He skied up to the base of it,
right,
which is not trivial.
I know.
And then we tried to climb the mountain, but it was avalanche-y and lots of other things.
It's a major mountain.
Yeah. And then Buckingham and a couple of other guys and I did maybe my only first ascent, which was the Ridge of Pagoda, something. It was a ridge on Pagoda.
Yeah. No, I thought it was the face of Pagoda. That's just
something up
a 30-year-old memory.
Yeah, it was something up there, and most of it was just 5'5", but there were two hard pitches which Buckingham led.
Yeah. Well, I climbed with him, and he did a couple of leads I could never win. Very happy to be second on the rope.
Right.
A hell of a good climb. Yeah. Willie, who's the other one? One who became a ranger at Glacier National Park.
Bill Colony.
Bill Colony. Do you know him or did you climb?
I climbed. My first climb on the east face of Longs was Alexander's Chimney.
Right.
Summer of 1952 with Bill Colony and Jimmy Boucher.
I know that she did it with him, but I didn't know.
Three of us.
Okay. Yeah.
And
as far as I know, that was her first ascent of Longs, period.
Yeah. And I was working at Dewey Ranch near Estes Park, where I could see the east face of Longs.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know how that climb came about. They came and picked me up, and we went up there and climbed that.
Yep. She's done Longs four times. That was probably, I guess, the first. We're moving up gently. You're doing a lot of climbing. The Mount Rainier thing, I thought we'd spend time on, but it looks like that was two summers when you were still in high school.
No, Mount Rainier was college.
Oh, in college.
Yeah.
Of course.
More and, by the way, another connection that I worked for Holubar's mountaineering.
Oh, yeah.
Two summers in high school, and then the summer after I graduated from high school.
That is worth getting.
Yeah. So I met a lot of climbers who came through from out of state, but to stop and buy things. This store was in their basement of their home.
Right.
I did all the mail order, wrapping the packages and sending
them out. So Alice was kind of your immediate boss, yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That was a strong connection to the climbing world. I also, that Jensen Ridge thing, this was also in high school. We got weathered off and we drove overnight to Yosemite and stayed in Camp 4.
Camp 4. It's a landmark now.
And they were so, I'm amazed at this. Within hours, we
had met Royal Robbins and Mark Powell.
Yeah.
And did a climb together.
Did you really?
We did a climb. There's something right near Bridal Veil Falls.
Yeah.
You go up and then you get at the top, and there's a pool you can swim in.
Everybody like it would be. The little world of climbers love to swim in that pool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Did you swim in it?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. Right.
So I got to meet the later, or the incipiently great Royal Robbins.
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember about him.
Well, he would have been what, in his late 20s or 30s?
Something like that.
Yeah.
A tourist came by when we were in the campground and said, "Why do you guys climb?" And although I don't remember what he said, I remember being extremely impressed with this calm, patient, good-natured, philosophical explanation by Robbins to the tourist about why people climb without any cliches or anything.
Really going well beyond them because it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a very tentative way on my little list. I'd love to interview him. Although he's published a lot about himself, and he might argue there's no need to, but I think we get on these tapes something people have never published. Anyway, that's another story. What if I do it? I'll say, "Yeah, you have to remember a boulder climber back."
Right.
Right. Sure. So, you've got Grand Teton experience, you've got experience in the Yosemite Valley. Was that your only time, or did you go back again and again?
No, I never went back to climb that. We climbed some other stuff there in the next few days, but I never went back as a climber to the Yosemite Valley.
Yeah. Well, I climbed with Buckingham three routes, and I've never been back since, so I don't think anything. He went out as a graduate student at Stanford while I was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, so we got together a little bit. How would you rank yourself among these half dozen, maybe more likely a half dozen climbing aficionados? And I don't mean ranking like Outside Magazine today would do it, who's the greatest climber and all, but some of them, I don't know whether you knew Leighton Koehr, but most people would say there was a super climber. There were others that were likable, but not that great. To me, Buckingham is maybe one of the best friction climbers I've ever known. Steep slabs.
Right.
How would you, phone in from the East, we're thinking we needed somebody we're going to fund somebody to do the severe climbs in the English Lake Country. Who can you recommend for Boulder? How would they describe you at that?
Not me. I was definitely second tier.
Second tier?
I was a second tier climber, definitely. I had limits on courage, and limits on talent, and limits on experience. Even though it was a passion, I was probably already drifting toward being satisfied just with all-purpose, general, rugged mountaineering. But I didn't have to be dangling by my fingertips.
Right.
And,
the adrenaline rush in and of itself wasn't that important.
I didn't need that. And it really later translated into more of a kind of a spiritual connection with the mountains.
Sure.
It didn't require vertigo to be stimulated.
Henry Thoreau rather than a thrill seeker.
Yeah.
Something we should have touched on, though, it runs through my mind. I think of you as a man of supreme endurance. You know, you can go on forever. Not everybody can do that, including some of our rock climbers would be appalled at a two or three or week long trip. What were your sports like in high school?
I ran the mile.
You did run the mile.
I went out for cross country running in the fall.
Okay.
But I was second tier
in
both of those.
I see.
I
don't know how long cross country runs go.
At that time it was only 3 miles.
Okay.
It is nothing now. Even for high school, but on the other, that was mostly because those weren't really my sports. I did have a lot of endurance for things that motivated me. For example, once I took my skis, put my skis on my bicycle. This was when I was an undergraduate, and I bicycled up from Boulder clear up to Rocky Mountain Park.
Right.
It was homecoming weekend, so it was November. There was early snow. I camped in the snow, skied all day the next day, and then bicycled back.
Another time, Pat Kaywood and I bicycled with our skis all the way up Boulder Canyon, all the way up the town of Eldora, walked all the way up the road from Eldora and climbed south Arapahoe Peak, and then skied down and bicycled home.
And talking about one day?
One day.
Jeez, pardon me, that's amazing.
That was...
I'm impressed.
We were exhausted. Well, when I think back about that, on that, that was an incredible endurance feat for us two young guys.
Yeah. But you had no doubt while doing it that you're going to be able to
do it. We didn't know if we'd make it, but we just did it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we just did it. Yeah. And I that's probably, that one, for a one day thing, that's probably the toughest thing I ever did.
Well, that would do it. Now, in college also, did you do any cross country or running or?
That was in college, I didn't know. I didn't go out for any sports in college.
And certainly not football or baseball. Like
nothing like that. Because the solo ski to Winter Park from Boulder was probably rank as an endurance thing.
Yeah, probably.
What's interesting to me about that also was that at some point I had acquired the necessary navigational skills and the necessary competence to travel alone in the winter. By the way, I still have the slide set of that trip, including the outrun of a huge avalanche that came down just south of the Needles Eye Tunnel. The whole hillside slid.
Really?
It went about half a mile out across the flats.
We're talking to Gwynn Valley, is that what
it is? Above Yankee Doodle Lake, south of Yankee Doodle Lake,
right.
There's another sort of head wall.
Yes, sir.
The whole head wall slid, went out across the flats. I've got the slides. I've got that trip is documented, and it also includes walking through some railroad tunnels.
Which still existed in those days.
Which still existed
in those days. And they kind of blocked them.
Yeah. And it was really spooky walking through those tunnels, wondering if a train was going to come.
Yeah. I walked through them before they walked them, but there were no trains with him. So.
Right.
Gee whiz. Yeah, so you've got slides going pretty far back.
I've got a lot of slides.
See, the sad things of my life is all my slides in early college through early Boulder were on Ansco chrome because my dad preferred Dakota chrome. And he taught photography at college. He was a physics professor, but one of his courses was photography. In fact, he wrote the Standard College textbook on photography. He was developing his own color process, and Ansco found out from some paper that he published that he was close enough to them that they bought him out, you know, so to speak. But from then on, he was all for Ansco, so I have all these wonderful Ansco films. And it faded. It was about 10 years ago, it began to fade. Now it's just in dreadful shape. So recently I took some of the Ansco film down to Amaranth and they played with it and they were able to rescue a couple of them. I've got a wonderful picture of Jenny doing the friction pitch on the XM route of the Grand Teton.
Right.
With Dan King way up here. You can just see his head belaying. She's on the friction pitch in Middle Teton and everything in the background. They were able to rescue that enough so that now it's a workable slide. I made a thing this big. It's worth mounting. We'll do it. But nothing to what it would have been with Kodachrome. So, by God, my dad has Kodachromes from Crater Lake in 1938, and they're as good as they ever were. So stick with Kodachrome is what I'm saying.
I've got a fairly well cataloged slide collection going all the way back.
Yeah.
And to college days. And right after college, I climbed in the Alps, and also in Norway. And I've got a good slide.
I mentioned that because one of the things I may do sometime, if I get around to it, who knows what we'll get around to at our age. I think the Alpen Club ought to have some basic color slide films in their library too.
Yeah.
Significant early things and so forth. And some of us might want to contribute that someday. But they don't have anything like that now. They do have wonderful prints. They've got Sella's original prints from the Duke of Abruzzi expedition, etc. They've got wonderful stuff like that. But and they've got a lot of Brad Washburn stuff, but nothing that I know of. Kodachromes yet. Anyway, that's another story.
Yeah.
We're edging up toward the famous climb. Is there anything that comes to your mind that's, well, say, of significance? I mean, it doesn't have to be major significance. Before we get out onto this famous trip with Howard with Houston.
There are two trips related to this.
Okay, let's
two
do them.
Previews.
For heaven's sakes,
two good. Previews of the high altitude pulmonary edema episode, which had I or anyone else at the time known could have prevented the
early,
real thing.
Yeah. Early symptom, okay.
I don't know if you want those.
Yes.
You want those
no,
first?
Let's do those right now.
Okay. All right.
Because with hindsight, this might have worked.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
As we will soon discuss, the famous trip was done with my college roommate Pat Caywood.
Pat Caywood.
Pat
K-A-Y?
C-A-Y.
C-A-Y.
Wood.
Okay.
New Year's 1959, but exactly the year before. That's why it's a little bit easier to tell this after telling the main story.
That's all right. You may have to go back and realize.
But a year before, almost exactly the same thing had happened.
Oh, really?
And the pattern was that I was in excellent shape, had gone for Christmas to visit my mother in San Francisco, had stayed at sea level for a week,
right.
Flown back, and then immediately set out on a trip. And this preview trip was right after Christmas in 1957, and on to New Year's 58, we skied. I flew back. We drove to Aspen. Skied immediately up to Ashcroft,
right.
To what at that the time was an old.
You
structure.
Skied up to Ashcroft, so the road was covered with snow.
Sorry, we drove as far as we could to Ashcroft, and then skied from Ashcroft
up to
the old, what was called the Old Red Mill, which is. Since been there was an old mining mill which
right.
had a room in it that skiers, cross country skiers used,
right.
And it's since been torn down, and it's roughly on the site of the present Taggart Hut.
I was going to say somewhere I'd heard that a mill. Now I know what its
yeah.
name was.
The Old Red Mill
was used, and then that's where they built
it. A place called Montezuma Basin. They stayed
right.
in
oh,
there.
Yeah. Right.
So skied around the next day, and about the next night I developed this cough. The morning after that,
and we're what, 10,000 feet or
no? Yeah, 10.8 I think.
10.8.
Yeah. Felt absolutely terrible, and thought I had some horrible flu or pneumonia or something.
Right.
And we just decided we were going to have to ditch the trip. It's about a 4.5 mile downhill ski out of there, which normally is done quickly and easily. And it was an absolute agony. I was utterly exhausted. I didn't have no balance. I couldn't stand up. It was quite distressing. But we got down, got to the car, drove home, and home being in Boulder at 5,000 feet. And
right.
within a day or two, I was perfectly fine.
Did you call a doctor?
No.
Didn't even go to it.
I got well so fast.
Well.
Which,
sure.
you know. We now know that's telltale sign of
high
altitude pulmonary edema is that the cure for pulmonary edema is to go down.
But you might have thought, well, maybe I had a bug or something.
Yeah.
I know those
yeah.
kinds of things that run through people's
yeah.
minds. Yeah.
So that was preview number one. Preview number two was the next summer when I was working at Mount Rainier.
Right.
I had Tuesdays and Wednesdays off, and I had two other guys, climber friends, who had
right.
we had contrived to get the same days off, so we went
right.
climbing every Tuesday and Wednesday.
Right.
And we climbed Rainier via the Winthrop Glacier and camped in the icefall.
We're in the icefall.
At 9,500 feet, took all these wonderful pictures of being in the icefall, and then continued on to camp there one night, and then continued on to the top.
Right.
And camped the second night on top.
On top?
In the summit crater.
14,400 something, you know.
What's that?
14,400
something,
yeah.
right. And they had a tent, and I said, I don't need a tent. And
no.
I, emulating my college friend Stu Krebs, who was a Montrose boy whose relation to the mountains as a kid had been one of just natural instincts rather than equipment.
Well, they had a. Okay.
Yeah. Rather
I wonder whether he knew anything about the San Juan Mountaineers in those days.
That's right.
Okay.
He was low-tech in a very original way.
Okay.
One of the original ways was to imitate Bowery bums by taking a Sunday newspaper along, taking each individual page and wadding it up and sticking it close.
Oh,
he had bivouacked on top of Long's Peak that way. It was just a newspaper wadded up. So,
well, I've done that twice with newspapers, yeah.
I did that in the summit crater of Mount Rainier. I had a sleeping bag, but I supplemented the sleeping bag with a newspaper that I had carried and wadded it up.
Seattle Intelligence.
That's right.
That's right.
But in the night, I coughed a lot and slept very badly. And I thought, and I was actually a little bit cold also. But I didn't.
Wait a minute, this was after the previous trip?
This is the summer after the...
The summer after.
After the...
Okay. The so by now you had this experience once.
I had this experience once. This is the summer after the trip to the Red Mill with Kaywood. And I get this cough again. I don't know whether I put two and two together or not. I don't think I did. But I had a very bad night. And it was hard to breathe the next morning. And I was very weak. But from... crater down to paradise. We went down the paradise side.
Right.
It's all downhill.
Down to the Muir Hut and on down.
Down to the Muir Hut and on down. It's all downhill. By the time we got to paradise at 5,000 feet, I was absolutely fine.
Wow. That's, again, well, now we know, but that's remarkable. Because even now, I mean, a lot of people would have to spend a day or so low.
Now, that probably hadn't been as bad as the trip to the Red Mill because I had been living at 5,800 feet at a fire lookout, so I wasn't declimatized like I had been going to San Francisco before the other trip. And I'd been, you know, climbing a lot, and so, you know, the attack wasn't as bad, but I'm sure in retrospect that both of those were onsets of high altitude pulmonary edema.
Oh, sounds very much like it.
So, so then it's from there, it's only 6 months to the famous episode. So I guess we're ready for that now.
Let's do the famous episode.
Okay.
Right. Tell me a little about your buddy, first of all. You done stuff with him?
Yeah, we were roommates and climbing friends, and he was strong and a willing, good shape, competent cross-country skier, climber. Also kind of a protege of Stu Krebs.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother had been killed on Mount Blanca, on a mountain climb trip, in 50 or 51, something like that.
You don't happen to know where, what part of Blanca?
I think on the Little Bear Ridge or something.
Oh.
He fell about 10 feet and a rock fell on him or something like that.
Oh, I see.
Because this naturally, and his father was a retired colonel, unable to, a prematurely retired colonel, trying to get into the job market and finding military skills not being accepted. And there was a period in our country's history when early retired military were finding it very difficult to get back in the job market. Consequently, he became an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. His wife became an alcoholic.
And that happened again and again.
When their son was killed, they became more of an alcoholic. So Pat later described himself as an adult child of alcoholics. But this gave Pat kind of a desperate edge to his climbing. And a little bit of an over-ambitious, a little bit of a recklessness, I felt, to his climbing.
Uh-huh.
Very gung-ho, but I didn't think his judgment was that great. That's just between you and me.
I know, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would have been overly cautious thereafter in order to safeguard ever hurting their parents.
But others,
it's almost like a form of denial.
It just translated to bravado.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the word.
Anyway,
right.
This is relevant to what transpired on this trip. Anyway, I, again, was in great shape. I flew to San Francisco to spend Christmas with my mother.
Right.
Spent a week at sea level,
right,
which we know now is enough to de-acclimatize.
That's right. Alas.
Flew back. I met Pat. We drove the same day I flew back. We drove to Aspen. Right. Slept on the snow beside the car. Skied the next day up the unplowed Maroon Bells Road.
Right.
In loose, dry, deep snow.
So you had to break trail.
I had to break trail all the way to Maroon Lake. Mm-hmm. Actually, the road might have been open for some sheep operation partway.
I know.
But basically, you skied all the way in
those right. days. It wasn't a tourist hangout yet.
Right. We camped somewhere above Maroon Lake on the way to Buckskin Pass.
Okay.
That night was the coldest night I've ever spent outdoors. It was 29 below.
Oh.
29 below.
But you're on the Maroon Bell Lake side of Buckskin. You're not over the top of
yeah, Buckskin. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Right. Then the next day was the big climb over Buckskin. And that's a non-trivial pass.
Oh, I know. I can somewhere put on skis. Yeah.
It's also
skis all the way.
It's also dangerous.
Yeah.
We didn't know enough. We were vaguely uneasy about avalanches, but we didn't have any kind of expertise at all. We had to cut through the cornice at the top.
We did.
We had an ice axe.
Yeah.
What was significant about that day, though, was that I was extremely irritable. It was what you'd call an extreme off day. I didn't yet know specifically that I was weak, except that Pat had to do most of the trail breaking.
Right.
But things just weren't right. And I specifically remember how irritable I was. I got mad at everything about my belt buckle and my shoelaces.
Very,
and everything.
Very common defense against a vague awareness I'm not quite right.
Yeah, exactly. So we cut through the cornice at the top of Buckskin after this horrendously long climb.
You doing your share of the work.
When I say we, I suspect that Pat cut through the cornice.
But you, yours, leads and so forth, or breaking through snow, or was
no? Pat broke trail.
So already he's doing most of
all the way up.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
But Pat's up was up for that.
Yeah. Okay.
That fit.
You're
right,
the ideal partner.
That fit right in. He got. You might say he got to break trail.
All right. Good.
Anyway, we dropped off the backside of Buckskin Pass, doing long switchbacks through 3 foot deep powder.
Oh my God.
Unaware of how innocently we were traveling through avalanche terrain.
That's right.
But we were now, this was the point of no return. We were now in what's now known as the Snowmass Wilderness, and it was very remote.
Oh, God,
back there in the wintertime.
Were you as far as Snowmass Creek?
We were as far as Snowmass Creek, okay. Almost as far as Snowmass Lake.
Yeah, okay.
And we camped that night, and that's when I began to cough.
And that would have been, 9,000, 10,000?
Higher, almost 11.
And closer to 11.
Closer to 11.
Yeah.
And I had a very bad night. Again, it was in the 20s, below zero.
Oh, my.
And we were both warm enough, but packing up the next morning was a sheer agony. And most of the work of that fell to Pat. Anybody who's ever winter camped knows how difficult getting started in the morning is.
Yes, it is.
Everything is so cold. It's rolling up the tent and stuff. Anyway, I was very ill. I could hardly hoist my pack up on my shoulders. I was coughing. I could hardly breathe. And I was utterly, utterly exhausted and just weak completely. And Pat blew up. This happened last year. Exactly the same thing happened last year.
He's detected the similarities.
Exactly. And it was. It was a carbon copy. It was a rerun of the year before. Exactly. And so he thought that it was something in me. He thought this was a self-generated disease.
That's my
that it was quitting, that it was copping out, that it was chickening out or something. Our goal was to climb Snowmass Mountain.
Right.
And it was clear that I couldn't do anything. And that we were stuck there in the, way back in the wilderness. And Pat was very angry. Very angry. But he recovered from that and became solicitous as we started to make our way down the Snowmass Valley. There was no right. question of going back up over Buckskin.
Right, yeah, yeah.
At that time, it was 15 miles down to either that monastery or the Snowmass Falls, the Snowmass Falls Ranch or whatever was
right,
back in there.
Right.
And it was heavy going and it was deep powdering. And I can remember so clearly standing, leaning over my poles, trying to breathe. Just, you know, I'd take a few steps and I'd lean over my poles and just go, trying to get breath.
As if you were 25,000 right. feet.
In a whole day of travel, at well below zero temperatures, we made less than a mile.
Oh boy.
That's how incapacitated I was.
Oh sure.
So we camped again. And Pat had rallied. He was being solicitous and caring. We camped again. I had a relatively good night, although Pat said I raved a lot that night.
Mm-hmm.
Just incoherent raving.
Right.
The next morning, I said, I'm better.
Okay.
Let's continue on down the valley. We got up, packed up. I went about 50 feet and collapsed. That wasn't better.
Yeah.
Just lying down and being at rest gave me the illusion
that that's all you wanted to do.
Yeah. So he set up the tent again.
Okay.
And put me in it, my bag, and left all the food and the Prima stove. And I think he even left me his air mattress. So I had a double mattress. And he went ultralight. Down the valley, and he got, I think he got to the ranch after dark, but it was really a heroic ski on his part. Heroic. Down the valley. And,
so he left you about?
He left me about probably 9 or 10 in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then it was clear, and he built a tent.
Yeah. Right.
And now he's going out.
Right. Now, at this point, probably Houston's narrative kicks in.
Well, let's hear what you,
okay.
what your version of it.
Okay. I spent that whole day lying relatively comfortably, and I didn't try to cook. I mean, I nibbled on snack foods. Pat later said that he worried all the way down the valley that in my debilitated condition, I would try to fire up the Prima stove and set myself on fire.
Oh, it's not a,
which is possible.
Not an impossible
that's
idea.
That's right.
Right. Were you drinking plenty of fluids?
I have no recollection.
Traditionally,
of that.
People don't do.
Yeah, no recollection of that. Probably not.
Yeah.
By the way, I had as a footnote, I had in fact had a precedent for burning myself up with a Prima
stove. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. With another college caper was. A ski over Pawnee Pass from Brainerd Lake to Monarch Lake,
mm-hmm.
and we camped near Crater Lake on
right.
the other side, and I tried to fill a Prima stove with liquid gasoline by candlelight.
By candlelight?
And I had a fire. I burnt the tent down.
Well,
and burned a huge hole in my sleeping bag, and it was this.
But you were able to get out of the tent. That
yeah,
sounds
yeah,
like
we saved our
lives.
You
did the right thing.
We saved our lives, but it was a near miss, and one of my, you know, least glorious mountaineering feats.
Let me repeat, your rara is tomorrow.
I don't know
as long
Pat,
as it doesn't happen to all.
Yeah, I don't know whether Pat knew that story or not, but in any case, he was very uneasy about having left the Prima stove.
Right.
So I left, it was a sunny day, no wind. I can remember how beautiful it was looking out. I had the door of the tent partway open. I was looking out into the sunny, snowy woods, and was
right.
relatively happy. On the other hand,
oh,
I had no idea whether anybody was going to come.